the normal way that the oil burner service people were setting the flame for maximum temperature, if that's what they were doing, was not giving them the right answer. And so all the sooty black stuff inside your flue pipes doesn't have to be there. Properly atomized and burned oil burns cleanly, in my opinion. Do you happen to remember Erwin Dresner's call letters, Dave, and to APG, K2RIW?
I don't know the negative.
Okay, we'll eventually find his call letters. But that was a nice bit of work that he did. Alrighty. Paul, how did you know that Roy was not available tonight? Is his laryngitis-like situation still in existence? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that was the last email that I got from him. So, what was it, day? It's okay, yesterday. Lost track of time. But, yeah, he's not right yet. But hopefully he'll be back next week.
I wonder if I'm on the distribution of that one. I know that one of his emails, he was making a joke about the fact that with his laryngitis, he could be handling the science talk by sending it in Morse code. And he came to the conclusion that if he did that, only one person would really appreciate it, WS2N. So is that the email we're talking about where he talked about doing the science talk with Morse code? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
I believe so. I think earlier on in that email, you'll probably find a sentence or two saying that he's still not right. Yeah, I believe that was one. I could check, but yeah, I'm sure. That's probably it.
Okay. Is your heating system in your house, Paul, gas-fired or oil-fired? Go ahead.
Oil. Oil. Hydronic system. Do I wish it was gas? Yes, I do. Back to you.
What makes you wish it was gas? And do you do your own oil burner maintenance? Have you ever considered it? Go ahead.
I've done basic oil maintenance years ago, but gave up. For $100, whatever it is they charge you to come and do it, they do everything. You don't have to take the flue apart, put it out. That gets all over the place. You have to use your own vacuum cleaner. It's not worth it. And then usually most of these companies you sign up with, they'll give you a discount. If you, you sign up with maintenance, I used to do that years ago. Now I have it separate. So I don't bother with it. I was wondering about Joe's boiler. He said 150,000 BTU. I'm not sure about the size of his house, but I used to have one of them. I think it was like 140 or something like that, the original 140,000 BTU. Eventually I went with 189, I think, thousand BTU. So, which is was a big difference. The other one just couldn't make it. Was like running all the time, to try to keep up in the cold weather. This one doesn't.
Ed White 2H.
Go ahead, Lou. And I'm wondering where the static is coming from tonight. On the new antenna, that's not supposed to happen. You got it, Lou.
Yeah, I did a QRZ search, and I come up with an old call for Erwin M. Dresner. And the call is Whiskey 2 Tango Romeo Papa.
That's the guy, W2TRP. His wife was also a ham. You may have found his wife too. Is that true, Paul? Lou?
Well, I put his first name in also. Perhaps if I just put the last name in, she'll come up.
I believe Irwin's a silent key now. Does that sound right to you, Lou?
Okay.
if you said something, Lou. If you did, nothing came through.
Yeah, and it said license expired. I'm going to do a search now on just the last name. Hold on one second here. All righty. Selma, WA2SHC, Selma Dresner.
That's her. Okay. So you may have heard earlier about his contract with Brookhaven Labs to investigate. And all that soot that's being removed from your flue pipes, Paul, wouldn't be there if the flame was properly adjusted, in my opinion. My son and I took our furnace apart recently, expected to do cleaning of soot, and we couldn't find any. Amazed the hell out of us. I think a lot of them are still being misset. Maximum temperature of flame sounds logical. It's not the right way to do it, because there is a distribution of particle sizes out of that atomized fuel, and you want enough air to burn the big particles so that they don't make soot to thoroughly oxidize them, as I see it. All righty, so we won't look for Roy, and it's time to go over to the space report. And as you can tell, I recently did the calculation of how fast the fuel must be flowing through that nozzle in order to make, in my case, let's call it 0.7 or 0.8 gallons per hour to go through that tiny little hole. Thousands of gallons of oil. It's got to be very well filtered so you don't get that clogged. And one other discovery I made, and that is I've got a thermal protect valve, where the oil line from the tank approaches the boiler. There's one of these fancy valves that if a flame took place, if the house was burning, the valve would automatically go to the closed mode. You don't want to be pouring oil into a burning house. Well, when I use that on-off valve, I do that, of course, when I'm, let me drop it. When I'm changing a filter element, of course, I'm turning that off. On one occasion, I changed the filter elements, put everything back together, forgot to open that valve, and turned on the oil burner. The oil burner created such an extremely high vacuum that the fine filter, the big white filter, it's not a filter, but it's a very fine-grained white chunk of a filter, it, under the vacuum condition, bubbling must have taken place inside, and it discharged fibers. Those fibers went through the system and jammed the nozzle. So you got to make sure you don't run your filter system out of vacuum. Otherwise, the bubbling creates fibers coming out of that filter, which when they get to the nozzle will jam it. That particular nozzle, when I get a chance, I'm going to take it apart and find out why it got jammed. But I know it's because I had made that mistake. So, what's going on in space, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And hold on one second, WS plant. You know, they're called firematic valves. So, two things, you know, you got to know about that. Yeah, if you have a fire, the top will come off, and they're spring-loaded, and they'll close automatically. That's how they work. But you also got to remember that, you know, most valves, when you close it, you have to turn it to the right. You know, clockwise. This is backwards. You have to turn it counterclockwise to shut it off. And that could be maybe why you might have made that mistake. But, you know, you could also tell by the stem. In fact, you just...
Yeah, there's some correctness and some incorrectness in what you just said, Paul. The thread on the knob that's on that firematic valve is a left-handed thread. When you turn it clockwise, the knob backs itself off, the rod goes inside and closes off the flow. So clockwise is still closing. counterclockwise raises that stem and opens the valve. So it's operating with a reverse thread, but still it follows the usual rule. Clockwise closes, counterclockwise opens. And that's the way Firematic works, but it does it with this reverse thread with that spring-loaded plunger that's inside. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Very good. Okay. So that wasn't the problem. But yeah, it's got a reverse thread. It seems backwards when you work, when you're using it.
Yeah, when you turn it counterclockwise, you're pulling up on the stem, which pulls the plunger up, which opens the valve. When you turn it clockwise, the knob in your hand is climbing the stem. The stem is being pushed in with the spring loading, and it closes off the valve. So by way of reverse thread, it still turns in the right direction. You got to be careful though when you're closing it off. When you turn clockwise, let me think now. Yeah, clockwise is when if you turn it too far clockwise, the knob in your hand will come off the end of the stem because it's a reverse thread. Clockwise makes it back off the threaded rod. You got a pull, K2RIW.
Yeah, I got two of them on my system. Is that what you have? You might have more than that, but that's usually what you have. Is that what you have, Dick, too?
By two, I guess you're saying you've got one at the tank and one at the burner. I've got an ordinary valve at the tank, but I've got one of them at the burner. All right, go ahead.
Oh, okay, very good. No, that's good. Yeah, well, I haven't had to shut mine off in a long time, but I do remember this reverse thread thing. Everything seemed backwards. So it's a shame you wound up with that problem, though. You know. As long as it doesn't cause too much damage, you know, you fire these things up, it's essentially firing it up without any fuel. It's worse than that. You're actually causing a vacuum. If it was, like, just low on fuel, that would be one thing. But creating a vacuum, I don't know what the heck what would happen there. Never tried that.
Yeah, I had left the Firematic closed off, ran the burner, it tried to run, and eventually the flame went out. But the reason the flame went out is because I think the white fine filter was internally bubbling, giving off fibers. Those fibers went into the nozzle and jammed it. So I had to replace the nozzle and replace that filter element. I think I had damaged that filter element by this vacuum procedure. The pump on your oil burner can make a pretty high vacuum. I also have a hollow bolt going into the filter can for the second filter. I've got a coarse filter and a fine filter. The fine filter has got a hollow bolt with a vacuum gauge on top of it, so I can see the amount of vacuum that occurs when either event occurs. If the pipe from the tank over to the burner becomes clogged, or if the filter becomes clogged with sludge and wax, in either case, the pump on the oil burner starts pulling a vacuum, and I see that vacuum on this gauge that's on that hollow bolt in that final filter. And so I can tell right away what's going on. And most recently, for instance, I was starting to see a couple of inches of vacuum out of 30 inches of mercury, I guess it is. I saw a couple of inches of vacuum. I knew that a slight clog was occurring somewhere when the burner was running. I replaced the two filters, and they looked pretty clean, and I still saw the exact same amount of vacuum. So therefore, I knew I had a partially clogged pipe. There's about 20 feet of pipe below the concrete of the basement that goes between the tank and the burner. And so I've got one of those CO2 blow guns where I connected it to the end of the tubing, rapidly blew the CO2 cartridge, blew the oil back into the tank at high velocity, which cleared out the sludge that was slightly clogging that pipe. And after that, everything was nice and smooth. So you probably don't own one of those oil pipe blow guns. Very handy tool. I think it's only about $20, but if you're doing your own service, it's the right thing to have. kind of amazing that the pipe going from the tank to the burner, in my case, is under the concrete. If that ever really became thoroughly clogged, life would get complicated. WS2N, KQIW.
It sounds... that doesn't... You have to go out and get a borscht gun and start chopping up your ground. For mine, it just runs around the boiler. And they have it covered with concrete, you know. I mean, you can break that up. It's above ground, but then it goes up a couple of feet and then through the wall of the house, concrete wall, and outside to a buried tank. Now, you have a furnace system. I have a regular boiler, for hot water heating system. And I think mine, when it runs, it really takes the heat out of the boiler with all that water. And I think the flue is probably on the cooler side and probably winding up with more. So I think when you have a furnace system like you have, I think your flue might be on the hotter side going up. And maybe that's the reason you're having, one of the reasons you have less soot. Before you made all those changes years ago, did you have a lot of soot? And then you noticed things changed after you made the changes running the different nozzles?
Absolutely. You've got it, Paul. The service guy that was servicing this house as I moved into it would come once a year and vacuum out the flue pipes and the boiler and whatever, and lots of black soot all over the place. And the burner ran kind of noisy and had a nozzle that, in my opinion, was way too big. I went to a smaller... I had to go to a smaller nozzle because when I opened up the air adjustment on the burner all the way, it wasn't enough air. My furnace, it's a warm air furnace. It's a... in other words, I don't have baseboard radiation. I've got ductwork. And the furnace came with a 9/10 of a gallon per hour nozzle, which is, in my opinion, way too big. I went down to 0.6 or 0.65. And now I can get enough air in there. I have an oil-fired ductwork system for heating. It's called a warm air system. I have a separate burner, oil-fired, for hot water with a center flue. And again, I'm using a smaller nozzle than it originally had. It doesn't have to be anywhere near as big as it was. And that also is a very clean burn. Very little soot takes place in that center flue pipe. Just as Erwin Dresden discovered, the majority of oil burners on Long Island are making too much noise, too much soot, too much carbon monoxide because they ain't getting enough air. You don't adjust the flame for maximum temperature. You adjust for enough air to get a clean burn. You want the largest of the atomized particles to get full burning. And so these two cascaded, let me drop this. These two cascaded filters I've got, a felt filter and this white foam, very, very fine filter. Those two filters take the oil from the tank through the two filters. Then it goes to a T-connector. The T-connector feeds the furnace in one direction and the oil-fired hot water heater in the other direction. Any of the articles you read say never feed one filter system through two separate oil burners. I've only been doing that for 30 years. And with this vacuum gauge, I know right away if any of the filters are starting to clog or if the pipe is starting to clog. So I've got a beautiful way of measuring the health of the system at that instant of time. And of course, what I do is I wait until a time when both the hot water heater burner and the house heating burner are both running simultaneously. And then that's when I look to see if there's any vacuum. And under normal circumstances, except when the tank is very low, there is no vacuum, as long as the filter and the pipe is clean. WS2N, K2RIW.
I'm starting to think you might actually have three filters. You got those two. And then the block on your pump that brings you up to 100, 150 pounds of pressure for your oil going in. Usually has a very fine screen filter attached to that. So, I mean, you could include that as a filter. If you did, then you'd have three.
As I said earlier, let me drop. Yeah, that's fine screening. When I first moved into the house, there was no other filter. The oil poured straight into the pump to that fine screen, which of course became clogged. I used to buy more of those fine screens and clean them up and change them and whatever. I never open up the pump anymore and look at that screen. All the filtering I do up to that point makes sure that what's going there is already clean. So I probably shouldn't look at that screen. I haven't looked at it in 10 years. There may be something in there. But I've really got four filters, Paul. The two cascaded filters, coarse and fine, the screening in front of the pump, and the nozzle itself has a sintered brass filter. So that oil goes through four series filters before it finally gets to the nozzle. WS2N, KQRIW.
Okay, that's very good. Very good. Yeah, okay, I got the inline filter, you know, the one that looks like an old oil filter that you would have on an old car, an old Chevy, you know, one bulb holding comes down, and that's all I got, that, and then the screen filter on the pump. But if they clean that out every year, I feel like, well, that's good enough. As far as efficiency, I could add another filter for a higher efficiency and then do what you do. See if that works. We'll see. Well, maybe we'll give that a go in the future. Back to you, Dick, and then I'll go on with the space report.
I've been at your house and I've seen your house. I'm not sure, but I'm guessing it's a three-bedroom house. Is your hot water heater, it's a hydraulic, so you've got baseboard radiation, hot water heating the house, and maybe it's an oil-fired, oh yeah, the boiler is also giving you the domestic hot water. So you and I are both getting oil-fired hot water and oil-fired heat in the house. And my house is rather poorly insulated, but still I burn around 1,200 gallons per year. Roughly how many gallons per year do you burn? And is your house a three-bedroom house, so... Paul, go ahead.
I would say, it's tough to, like this year, it's great. You know, I'll probably be in the 900-gallon area because it's been a very good winter. But, no, you could have these zero, minus degree series of days, you know, where you're going through 5 gallons a day. You know, I've never gone that high, but probably... four anyway. That's a good way to think of it. You know, how many gallons did you go through on the coldest day when you hit, minus 2 degrees? You know, I'm probably up near 4 gallons. Usually I'm around 2 gallons a day if it's like now, two and a half gallons, no more than that. Back to you, Dan.
Paul, how do you know how many gallons you burn? Maybe because you know the gallons per hour of the nozzle, and maybe you've got some kind of a timer that tells you how many hours the furnace burned that day. So other than that, how do you know how many gallons you burned a particular day? Back to you, Paul.
Well, I have a chart, and I can tell you by measuring my tank how many gallons I could go through, let's say, a 10-day period. You know, let's say you have 10 real cold days, I can measure the tank, which I've done in the past. And you take those 10 days and you just do the math on how many gallons you went through. And I have a chart. I go back to the 1980s with my chart. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, you make it sound like you know how many gallons were in the tank before and after the 10-day period. That depends on the accuracy and linearity of the fuel gauge on the tank. And that's not a linear gauge. It's a slightly crazy mechanism.
Like six-foot ruler.
Okay. your six-foot ruler already. You know the dimensions of the tank. You know the number of inches of oil in the tank by way of the ruler. That allows you to do a pretty good job of calculating a volume. Okay. Now I believe you. So I think you're saying on the worst cold day, a minus degree day, you burned something like 9 gallons. Is that what you said?
No. Maybe 4.5. It's probably my worst. Probably 4.5 gallons.
But is your ruler accurate enough that you can see the oil change accurately enough for just one day of oil height change in the tank? Can you really not? With 10 days, I agree with you. With one day, I don't think you can get enough accuracy out of the ruler technique. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'll go a week or 10 days. If I'm experimenting like that, you're going to do one day, it's not going to work out, you know. So, you know, naturally, let's say you have, you know, a cold spell where every day is 20 degrees, you know. And you know that's going to be roughly the forecast in the future. You just want to see how things are going. You can do it that way. But not on a daily basis, no. I mean, you know, my chart shows inches. So there might be 7 gallons difference for 1 inch, roughly. And naturally, there's a curve to the tank. But when you get near the top or near the bottom, so the chart shows that. You know, if you do get very low, you'll see that it's not a 7 gallon difference anymore. You know, it might be a 6 gallon difference per inch. But it's roughly seven gallons per inch. So naturally, you extrapolate when you look at it, and you can figure out, you know, if it's 3.5 gallons or 3 gallons, whatever it is. If it's a quarter of an inch, you know what it is. That's how I do it.
I'm going to guess that your tank that's buried in the ground outside of the foundation is a 275-gallon tank. And I guess eventually you got to worry about if that ever starts rusting and leaking fuel. Over to you, Paul.
I don't like to talk about that. that's a problem. Years ago I used to put them in, and they were all really good. And you would take out old ones, and some of them look like the new ones that you were putting in. So you got to hope for that. Maybe it's in a pretty dry area relative to the rest of the, like you might have a slope in your backyard, and that's where your tank is. And maybe it's always, it's got a water line, a bad water line where it's getting water. It might be very sandy. You might get a lot of air there mixing in with the water, creating a situation. Who knows? You keep your fingers crossed for something like that. In the future, like when all these houses are sold, they require people to, when you sell it, you have to change that, or the next buyer has to, sign off for it and change it. They want the tanks above the ground out there.
Yeah, the nice thing about the tank being below ground is I guess it doesn't get the oil super cold as it would be above ground. And I guess it would be very tempting to put a shed, to build a shed above the tank in order to keep the rainwater off of the tank area to make sure it doesn't rust. That would be kind of tempting. So I guess you're saying when you moved into your house, they hadn't yet established the rule where you had to change the tank. So you're grandfathered with that tank as long as you want to be. Is that what you're saying, Paul? Go ahead.
That's QSL, unless something bad happens, and like you said, if something started to rust out. But I would know right away, because I check on a regular basis, because you have to know when you're going to get the next oil delivery. And that goes back to the beginning of that, when I said if they put a gas main down Motor Parkway, I'll be the first one to hook up.
So how many miles from you do you think is the nearest gas main? It's question number one. And 275-gallon tank, and I guess every month and a half you have to have it refilled in the wintertime. Is that roughly true?
not too bad. But a bad season every 6 weeks would be, you know. But, you know, you'd have that bad area, bad time frame. It would be 6 weeks. But then you'd start getting a little warmer, and that would turn into 8 weeks, you know. But, you know, at the worst part of it, you know, you're down in the six-week area. And they call it 275, by the way. You know, I never put that in. Most I ever go up to about 238.
That's the exact number I go to. I know exactly how low it is, and I order the oil in the spot market. There are times when I'm paying 20 cents less per gallon than everybody else who's got a contract up for. That's the good news. I'm getting a nice price. The bad news is I've got to hand him cash when he does the delivery. There was another question I had. Oh, what was it now? Tank? No. Oil? How close is the nearest gas line? Oh, yes. They come, in your case, roughly once per year and vacuum out your system, remove all the soot. And is that when they change the oil filter? Is your oil filter your inline felt filter that looks like the kind of filter that goes in a diesel automobile? Does that get changed, in your case, only once per year? There are some cases where I might be getting a delivery that's pretty waxy. And by way of my vacuum gauge, I can tell that the coarse filter is starting to clog in less than a year. So changing that filter, in your case, once a year, is that always enough? Back to you, Paul, K2RIW.
So far, so good since late 1970s. Other problems, but not that. Transformer will go. The service guy will be here, and he'll leave you got your two electrodes. One guy left it too far apart, worked for a while, and then stopped working. Weird things like that. The control box on the burner had to be modernized. That failed one time. Had to change that out. See, that's the thing. You don't want to. You got to. If you do what you do and you service it all the time, you're in good shape. If something fails, you can probably diagnose it very quick and maybe you have a spare part laying around or something. Suppose this quits at 2 o'clock in the morning and, you know, you don't have a spare part around. You know what it is. You want to be able to pull a guy up within 24 hours to be able to service it. Different things you got to think about. That's it, you know. I mean, I put my own, when I put the boiler in, all I had to do was, the guy brought the boiler downstairs and I installed everything. Put the old burner back in, all of that, many years ago. I'm getting tired, Dick. I don't think I would do that anymore. That's it, back to you.
Your domestic hot water, let me drop it. Your domestic hot water comes from a coil that goes into the boiler. So the water from the street flows through that coil and inside the boiler. The water gets hot and then goes to your shower or your hot water faucet. Does that piece of tubing ever get clogged and need replacement, Paul? And how long have you had the current boiler in the house? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I got a Utica, which I like. And probably, let's see. I'd say 30 years. And yeah, the inline domestic coil failed a couple of years ago. So that had to be changed out. When I say fail, you know, eventually it develops a leak in the coil. And because the domestic hot water, the domestic water runs at roughly around 50 pounds, 55 pounds of pressure here. And the boiler system, well, you don't have a boiler in your house. pounds, but your hydronic system works around 12 to 14 pounds per square inch. That overpressurizes your heating system and blows your relief valve, and you wake up and you find water all over the basement. And that's how you discover that. And then you call the guy up and tell him, I need a new vacuum.
Yeah, that's a bit uncomfortable. And that developed a hole and a leak because of dissimilar metals. My guess is your boiler is probably made out of steel. That pipe that gives you domestic hot water is probably made out of copper. Whenever you bring copper and steel together with a fluid in between, like water, and there's a little bit of mineral matter in the water, nobody's got water that's that pure, you've got current that's flowing, and therefore it's developing pinholes. I used to develop pinholes on the copper pipe that went to my hot water heater before I isolated it with the PVC couplings. So there's probably a way of isolating that coil so you don't get this galvanic action. And I presume you've also, you needed a replacement of the domestic hot water coil. Have you also had a time when the furnace didn't fire? That's because the igniters were too great a gap. And the transformer will periodically fail. I've replaced transformers about three occasions over the 30 years. The modern transformer that they sell me is now transistorized fired. And it looks to me like it's a lot more reliable. It's half the volume, maybe one-third the volume. And it's transistorized fired, so that makes a much bigger spark with much lower current, so it doesn't burn the ends of the tips on the igniters. In the old days, the current flowing through that transformer, through the tips, would slowly erode the tips. They'd have to be filed down and reset periodically, and the igniters would have to be periodically replaced. But the new transistorized one, I don't think I'll ever be replacing igniters.
Keep that in mind for the next time the transformer blows. I blew that one failure on that. But, okay, that's good to know. Transistorized system, it sounds a lot better to me. And let's see what else I was going to say about it. Inline coil. No, it wasn't electrolysis that failed. I mean, it's just, like water wearing away at one of the bends. Traveling around and eventually, the Grand Canyon, eventually it's going to wear a hole in something. If it was electrolysis, it would be usually where you make your connections. And if there's steel involved in copper, you're going to have a big problem. So I tell you that, they make unions that are completely isolated. Wanted to use that was insulated, just the two insulators involved in that type of a union. I guess you could do that before and after, and that would be a safe way to go to prevent any electrolysis. That's probably the best. I don't know if you've ever seen them, Dick, but they work good.
I guess that there's ways of buying a union. Probably it's a ceramic device with the right threads on each end that'll give you a voltage isolation on a piece of copper pipe. I did it with PVC fittings, which is probably not the code. The pinholes that I used to get in the copper pipe that was near my hot water heater, but it was quite a few feet away, and the length of that pipe would develop pinholes. So if the real galvanic action was taking place between the water and the pipe, not where the pipe touched the hot water heater per se. And, of course, hot water heaters tend to rust away real fast and use up their sacrificial rod. Now that my hot water heater is isolated, I remember after 10 years looking at the sacrificial rod in the center, and it looked like it was brand new. Nothing had changed. So my hot water heater may last an awful long time, and it doesn't develop pinholes in the pipe anymore. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's a terrible problem. I used to be a problem years ago. For some reason, that doesn't pop up that much anymore. These pinholes in there. And they were always popping up in the elbows, right?
In my case, it was popping up in the straight section of pipe, not at the elbows. And in your case of the domestic hot water coil, are you saying that it was Mississippi River, in other words, the meander of the river, you're saying that it failed at the corner where it makes a bend? I still think that the possibility exists that that's where the galvanic action was taking place, Paul. That coil was not isolated, and so you've got a steel boiler, conductive water, copper pipe, and domestic water flowing through it. So you got all kinds of ways that galvanic action could be taking place. You may have thought it was a wear and tear of the water going around the corner. I still think the mess. I think electrolysis could have been a contributing factor, Paul. K2LAW.
Yeah, I don't think so. I've seen a lot of electrolysis failures with the copper and the steel, and it's always at the joint. You could have a steel plug put into a copper tank, or the other way around, a steel tank with a copper plug, and, you know, over time, it'll just eat away at that copper, and it will, you know, copper and steel, and it'll blow out on you, you know, if you have enough pressure. I've seen that. But midway down midstream, I don't know. I guess it's possible. I'd have to research that one thing.
Yeah, not easy to explain, but it happened to me. From what you were saying earlier, have you been involved in removing in-ground oil tanks? And at times you saw them not in good shape. Is that what I think you were saying earlier, Paul? Go ahead.
That was a condominium out east where the tanks were removed, and they were actually essentially putting up new condominiums. Everything was new, and the new ones were no longer being put on the ground. You know, they all had their own little boiler room. So that's what that was about. Not a lot of them, you know, but, you know, it makes you wonder, you know, some contractors will get the job, you know, take all of these things out, and who knows, maybe there were more of them that were no good, and, you know, the ones I saw were good.
What do you believe is the reason why your tank is in ground as opposed to the tank being inside of the basement itself, Paul? Go ahead.
I guess that was just, you know, I mean, it was a development. Well, you've seen the place. It's a development, and that was the deal they had. I don't know. I didn't research it that much. You know, it's just like we have underground wiring here, but you go a block away, and it's all above the ground, you know. That's what they signed up for, and, you know, that was legal at the time. And look at these people with the septic system. You know, they have block system. Now it's all concrete. You know, mine was concrete, so I'm okay. But if it was 10 years earlier, you know, you find yourself changing that out too.
Yeah. In your neighborhood, is the sewer system individual cesspools at each house? That's what I've got at my house.
Unfortunately, and again, if I knew they were putting a main down the center of the street, tying into the Lindenhurst sewer district or something, I'd be the first one to sign up for that one too.
In other words, you've had some troubles with your cesspool. Soon after I moved in, I had them add another cesspool cascaded with the one that was there. So now I've got the total of two cesspools in front. One flows into the next, and they don't fill up anymore. And we don't have young kids anymore where we're washing a zillion diapers every day. Over to you.
Well, how about the septic? So, yeah, you got a regular septic tank and then cesspools. That's what you have, right?
Negatory. My waste flows out of the house into a piece of Orangeburg pipe that goes across the lawn into a cesspool. And now in my case, it goes into a cesspool, which dumps into another cesspool a little bit further downrange. And that Orangeburg pipe down. As the soil settled, the pipe was being held up by the cesspool at the far end, but going down to a lower level at the somewhere in the middle, and the net result was that the stuff would jam at the uphill place. I dug down and drilled another hole from the side of my cesspool so that the Orangeburg pipe, or the adapter that I put in there, could now have a straight run to accommodate the fact that the pipe had settled to a lower level, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
K2QBV.
Okay, another station. Okay, well, I got the tank, septic tank, and then cesspool system, so different setup. The other station, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a TechNet. I just turned it on, didn't want to interrupt. Just you two guys, right?
No, this is still the TechNet, but we got involved with the home improvement topic. I'm supposed to go on with the space report, but that's been delayed a little bit. Back to you.
Oh, okay, Corey. I haven't spoken to K2RIW since his middle of the night when I was in Singapore 5 months ago. I don't know if you remember that. K2RIW, I will be clear for any comment, K2QBV.
Yes, Joel. At some crazy hour, you got on from Asia. I heard you and talked to you. And Pomona, New York. There was a company that used to make boxes for containing electronics, the Pomona Company. That's way back in the dark ages. Back to you, Joel.
Yes, I'm aware that I knew the company name. Yes, it was my afternoon in, I don't know, middle of an ICU. Only spoke to two guys in the middle of the night. I went to take a nap in the afternoon. I was tired. But it was good. Nobody else was on from Singapore. I mean, I could even work. No other 2 meters group. All right, goodbye. You guys have fun. Sorry to interrupt, but just heard a familiar voice. K2QBV, Pomona, New York.
And Joel, there's a man who signs in from Japan periodically onto this machine, I guess by way of Echolink. Have you heard him? JA2SVG or something like that.
Yes, I did hear him and I did speak to him. And I tried to email him, tell him to come on more often. We're working regularly. The band's so terrible, exciting to work JA. We don't hear too much here, and I'm on that mountain here. Yes, I did. Back to you, continue. Sorry to interrupt.
Perfectly all right. Okay, so I guess it's time you tell people what's going on in space, Paul. We've discussed oil, cesspools. So you've got a septic tank and then a cesspool, not a leach field. And mine just goes straight into a cesspool, two cesspools on the property. In fact, there may even be three. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Very good, very good. Yeah, and everybody raves about how good the economy is. To me, the economy is good when I got a gas line and hook up to some kind of a town cesspool system. Then I would say the economy is great there. All right, let me do the space net report. Back to you, Dick, unless you want to make another comment, or anybody else for that matter.
You've got a book.
Okay, very good. Now today, we'll start off with what happened today, because we're way behind schedule. We've been missing for a couple of weeks, but today they had an abort test by SpaceX with the Crew Dragon vehicle. This test has been planned for many years, and they tried to put it off as long as possible because they wanted to make sure everything that could be done with the crew vehicle. Vehicle is done before they run a test. SpaceX is the company that developed the Dragon spacecraft. They've been sending up cargo vehicles for years now to the space station with the Falcon 9 and the Dragon attached to it. Now they got the contract for sending another Dragon, they call it the Crew Dragon, up to the International Space Station. And they hope to get that accomplished probably within maybe April, May, or June, I'm thinking. But they've been leading up to this for a long time now, and they have to do a series of in-flight tests to make sure that an abort system would work if it was needed. So far they've completed a paired inboard test back in 2015. They took the Dragon vehicle, the Crew Dragon vehicle, and put it on a launch pad in Florida and lit off these Super Draco engines, they're called. They're liquid fueled, hypergolic fueled engines. So, you know, the second they mix with the nitrogen tetroxide, they instantly ignite and they wind up full thrust, pulling the crew away from the supposedly exploding booster that they're sitting on. So that worked successfully back in 2015. But yet they still wanted to do an in-flight abort test. Before all that happened last March, they wanted to also send a crew vehicle up to the International Space Station dock and bring it back safely and land it in the water without a crew. And that was accomplished as well. So that was two main tests. This is the third test. In-flight abort test. So in other words, you're going uphill, supposedly you're going to the International Space Station, you get about 10, 12 miles high, and you realize there's a problem with the booster, and you would be in trouble. This is all done in, as they described on the news conference by Elon Musk, he said this all happens within 0.07 of a millisecond, so less than a second. The rocket engines, Falcon 9 rocket engine, you know, it's about 1.7 million pounds of thrust when you take off, and you're going uphill. You're supposedly going to the International Space Station. The booster shuts off, and the Crew Dragon detects the anomaly and instantly lights off the Super Draco engines. Super Draco engines are part of the crew vehicle. They surround the crew vehicle. There's a total of 8 of them. They run, there's like 4 sets, so in each set there's two Draco engines. So when they fire off, it's around 160,000 pounds of thrust, which is over twice the amount of thrust, for instance, that Alan Shepard had when he was, you know, launched on a suborbital flight on a Redstone rocket with his Mercury vehicle. And that was able, you know, enough thrust to get him up, you know, to 114 miles up and landed, you know, safely in the ocean. Well, this is a much heavier vehicle than, you know, the Mercury vehicle. This thing weighs many tons. I think it's 20,000 pounds, is a little bit more than that. So the Super Draco engines successfully fired after 84 seconds of flight, separated from the booster. They show the booster, this is all live, it happened this morning around 10:17, it went off. They show the booster, it explodes because they have the charges in there. Has an anomaly, its computer blows itself up, and the Crew Dragon successfully goes flying away and goes through apogee, which was around a little over 20 miles high. At that point, the back end of the Crew Dragon separates, called a trunk. The whole Dragon system is around 27 feet tall. So the bottom half is called the trunk. That's where they would normally bring up unpressurized satellite equipment or, you know, other equipment. They would load it into that trunk. It's also covered with solar panels, and that's how they're going to develop electricity when they are and all. So the trunk separates, and eventually that, you know, just lands in the ocean. But the crew vehicle keeps going, and it reorients itself, changes its attitude using regular Draco engines. See, there's engines, and then Super Draco, you know, got it away from the booster with a collective thrust of 160,000 pounds of thrust, and then you have 18 different thrusters on the Dragon itself to steer it, and that's what they would use, you know, if they were going to the space station. In this case, it just reoriented itself with the shield facing down. Then they start accelerating, and through all of this, they only get up to around 4.5 G. So, you know, it's not going to kill the astronauts if you're on board. By the way, they had two dummies in there with all kinds of sensors and everything, and, you know, sitting in the seats. So, soon after that, the trunk had separated. The drogue chutes come out, two little drogue chutes come out, and stays like that for about almost a minute, and eventually they pull out the four mains. Each main was around 100, I think they said 118 feet in diameter. Well, there was four of these parachutes, each one over 100 feet in diameter, big red and white parachutes. And sure enough, the vehicle came back and landed in the rough seas of high waves. This WS2N. They knew it was going to be high waves. You know, in fact, they scrubbed the day before because of high winds out in the ocean. The waves were a little bit better, just manageable. So they had SpaceX had their own boats. They went out to meet the Dragon. After about an hour or so, they were able to bring that on board, and I guess presently it's on the way back to Cape Canaveral, where they're going to investigate it, see how the dummy's made out, and all of that. So that's the story on Crew Dragon. Hopefully everything goes good, and they'll be able to eventually send a crew up. Within a few months anyway. So that's the story on that. Does anybody have any questions about this test that SpaceX did today?
Question, how do I get checked in? I've been listening for an hour and a half. This is KN4ZFB, Billy out of Bethlehem, Georgia.
Oh, K5, this is KA4ZNZ, I got, I don't know if that's right, Zulu, November Zulu. This is Paul, WS1, Whiskey Sierra 2 November. And if you're on Echo Link, sometimes it's a problem. I don't know if they straighten that out, but you're making it now. Back to you.
Net Control, this is Kilo, November 4, Zulu, Foxtrot, Bravo, Billy out of Bethlehem, Georgia. Good evening to everyone on the net. I have been listening for the past, I guess, hour and a half or so about the problems or the dilemmas between furnaces and oil heat up there. So not necessarily a problem we hear about here down in Georgia. Very entertaining and a different perspective of how life is from where I'm at. Back to net control. KN4ZFB.
Okay, fine business, Bill. KN4ZFB. And yeah, this is Paul. Whiskey Sierra 2 November. And what you've joined is the TechNet, which is been going on since the 1980s, and the TechNet is on every Sunday night. It sounds like you probably know that, but we're on from 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock at night, and it's run by Dick at K2RIW, and he's the other fellow that you were listening to about the oil burners, and he's on the side right now, but we always start off with the technical questions at 8 o'clock, and eventually we go into what's called the science talk with another ham Roy AC2GS, and then eventually follow that up with the space report, which I'm doing now, which usually involves what NASA's doing or, you know, what's new with satellites and ham radio equipment in space and that type of thing. So, Billy, you want to make any comments or questions? We'll turn it over to you. KN4ZFBWS2N.
WS2N, KN4ZFB. Yeah, Paul, I have a question that you may be able to give some guidance and some clarity on. I am fairly new to ham radio, so you will have to forgive me for my nomenclature, technology, knowledge, and all of that. However, I do stem from a background that involves RF from professional audio and lighting and stuff that I've done in the past. So I do have a question. I am new to ham radio, and I have literally just gotten myself into a position where I'm about to take my general, and I was looking at HF radios and the technology behind all of that. I guess the HF bands being down at its kind of lowest peak and starting to come back into fruition, I was looking at something like the Yaesu 991A and see if anybody on the net may have a positive, negative, or an indifferent review of that unit. KN4ZFB, back to you, Paul.
Very good, Bill. Billy, I don't have the Yaesu 991A, but I've heard of people that do. And, you know, based on my experience, I was always happy with the three main companies, Yaesu, Kenwood, and ICOM. And I've had a Kenwood HF, and thinking about getting an ICOM next time. And Yaesu, a lot of people have Yaesu as well. I've worked on the Yaesu 440D. I like that one. It wasn't mine, but somebody else had it. Very good radio, but you know, I'm sure you'll be happy with that. You know, it sounds like you're going to get a new one. That's what I would do. Some people get old ones, and they just, you know, they think, well, a signal is a signal, and they're right. But I've pretty much gotten new ones. Don't have the ability to fix up the old ones if they're failed, unless it's something simple. So I don't want to buy a broken one. I don't know. You know, then you have to think about antennas, what kind of antennas you're going to use, and all of that. So let's see if anybody has any experience with the Yaesu 991A. Anybody out there? This is WS2N.
KC1SAM.
Hi, Sam. How you doing? KC1SAM. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm using it. I like to call it the Yaesu Canadian radio. The FC991A, as they would say. not the place probably to give a big long report, really, but very happy with it. Works good all day, and I don't do a lot of HF. But it works good, and I'm happy with it. Get other opinions if you can, but this is one opinion that's very positive. Back to you, Paul. You can sort it out.
Okay, very good, Sam. Thanks for that. And I didn't realize you had that radio. That's good. And okay, we have one experienced Sam that likes the radio, Billy. Anybody else want to comment? Okay, very good. I guess you hear that CW. That's WT2VL repeater. That's where we are in New York. I'm in Long Island, Suffolk County. Back to you, Billy. KN4ZFBWS2N.
Wow, Paul, sorry about that. The transmit button disappeared on the Echolink software on my phone here. So to kind of give you a rundown of what I have, I've got a 2-meter, 70-centimeter, and I've got a Kenwood TH-74D, and an ICOM ID-5100. Yeah, that's what this is. ID-5100. So I've got my 2-meter and my 70-centimeter and 1.25-meter taken care of. I'm just looking primarily for an HF radio that's going to give me stellar response, and I could use it in QRP or get up to 100 watts out of it. So anybody else has any other solutions or preferences or anything out there, I would totally love to hear that. I live in a neighborhood down here in Georgia that is probably an acre of land down here, so I'm not bunched up right next to anybody. So I have the availability to put up the antenna should it be required. So I've got that availability with no HOA, so it's really nice to have that. Anyways, back over to you, Paul. KN4ZFC.
N2YC with a comment.
N2YC, go ahead.
Thank you, Next Control. Name here is John from Hyde Park. Billy, you mentioned portable, I think, in there also. So the 991 is a pretty substantial rig. If you're going to bring something portable, and being that you basically want HF and you might not need the UHF VHF that the 991 has, you might want to go with the FT-891 or the FT-450D. The 450D has a built-in tuner, and the 891 is even smaller, both 100 watts. Billy?
I won't lie. Yes, I see where you're saying that the 891 being a lot smaller rig. What I do like about the 991 is the fact that plug everything up, and I could do like an FT8 or any other the digital modes that are out there to be able to transmit. So easy peasy on the transmissions and digital modes for HF. I wanted to make it easy, and I still want to have my availability. And the 991 that I have will fit in my Go box that I already have my 2-meter stuff in. So it's all kind of like a one little box thing. It was that or the ICOM. I think it was a 7300 that I was looking at, HF radio. Both of those were kind of comparable. So the ICOM was a little less money, but the A2 gave you a little more flexibility. That was kind of where I was. I wanted something nice, something I could use for a home rig, or if I decide to go out with it, I can take it in my camper and stuff, and I've got it all nicely racked up in a rack system. This is KN4ZFB.
Okay, very good, Billy, and John, thanks for the help there. And, I was looking at the Icon 7300. If I get another one, that's going to be the one I'm getting. I've read a lot about it, and that looked good, too. On New Year's Eve, they have something called Straight Key Night, where people, even if you have an iambic key, that you send Morse code with, people use the Straight Key just for that night. I try to get at least one contact in, and sure enough, I did do that this year, and the guy I contacted had the ICOM 7300, so, and he sounded real good. I don't know. Again, I like the ICOMs, the Kenwoods, and the Yaesu, but the one that John just mentioned, the Kenwood, not the Kenwood, the I, Well, this is Yaesu 450D. That's the one I used. I've used that a couple of times. It's not mine. I said 440D. I meant to say 450D. And that was a very good radio, so I like that as well. All right, we're going to continue on. Unless you have any other last comments, Billy, we'll continue on with the SpaceNet report. Let's see if I had a call right. KN4ZFB, Zulu Foxtrot Bravo, WS2N. Billy?
At this time, I have nothing more for the net, so we can go on and continue on with the space report.
Paul, this is Dick. I'm going to be away from the rig for a little while. I'm hoping to come back before we close off, but if not, you might be closing down tonight. I'm going to be away for at least a half hour. WS2N, K2RIW.
K2RIW, WS2N, no problem. And not a problem. And, yeah, we'll hang out. And continue with the SpaceNet report. We were missing for a couple of, Billy's still listening, but we were missing for the last couple of weeks. A couple of us got sick, and we're just going to make it. There's usually three of us here, and most, 90% of, 99% of the time, you'll have a TechNet here on Sunday night from 8 p.m. To 12 p.m. And unfortunately, some of us key up too quickly. I do the same thing. And when that happens, it's very hard for anybody on Echo Link to get in. So we all try to practice not doing that. But as you can tell, you tried for an hour or so to get in. And thanks for your patience. And you did very well. I mean, you sound good here in New York. Let's continue on back on the 6th of Monday. So it was a Monday, 6th of January. There was another launch by SpaceX. And what they did was launch another Starlink mission to put another 6,500-pound satellites into orbit. For people that don't know, the Starlink program by SpaceX is to set up a worldwide broadband satellite system in relatively low Earth orbit, you know, from 350 to, 450 miles up. They plan on having a lot of different inclinations and countless satellites, and right now they have a total of 180 satellites up there. They've made three of these launches so far, each one with 60 launches over the last half a year. And their goal is to eventually have 4,000 satellites, and they've already put an application in to try to put into up to 30,000 satellites over the next, say, 5 to 10 years. But this year they plan on launching 24 Starlink missions. They've already started, like I said, on the 6th of January they launched one. They plan on doing another one in another week or two. Their ultimate goal is to launch 24 satellites, 24 launches with a Falcon 9 rocket, and each one having 60 satellites on board. And they're well on their way. 180 and another 60 coming within a week or so. And by the end of this year, they think they should have enough satellites to start operations. People will be able to sign up with them for broadband hookup and TV, 4K, the whole bit. If all goes right, he's got these antennas that he's going to be selling. He's got to set up a factory to manufacture these. It looked like, to me, that I saw a picture of it. It looks like it was around 18 inches, a little bit less in diameter. They look like small flying saucers. You know, they got top and bottom to it. I haven't seen what's on the inside yet. But they're supposed to be electronically steered to keep in contact with these satellites that are moving at 17,000 miles an hour overhead as one switches from one to the other. But they seem to state that there's apparently a motor inside these things, so they're able to... It doesn't sound like it's going to be only electronically steered. It's going to have some kind of a movable system inside. But he's got to bring the price down. They said, you know, the only manufacturer of something similar to this is like in the $1,000 bracket. He's got to bring the price down to, you know, hundreds of dollars or less, you know, less than 300 at least to get people to sign up with this. So I'm not sure how that's going to go. But he eventually plans on having people connect worldwide with the Starlink system. He's going to have up to 42,000 satellites by the end of the decade. He needs a couple of thousand. He needs, by the end of the year, he should be able to have enough. I think they said 1,200 satellites to make things, you know, function in the United States. But because of all the different inclinations, he's going to be able to, you know, there's going to be people in the North Pole or South Pole that will be able to utilize this system. He's not the only company that plans on doing this. I know Jeff Bezos from Amazon has a plan on doing something similar, not with as many satellites. There's NetOne, another company that they've already launched one group of satellites. I think they're pretty much using the Soyuz rockets from Russia to launch their satellites. But SpaceX is doing everything in-house. The satellites, they're building themselves. The rockets, they're building themselves. And these are all reusable rockets, except for the one that they use today. They planned on blowing that one up, and they did blow it up on that test flight I talked about earlier. But their anthropometric mannequins had all sorts of equipment all over them, and I'm anxious to find out how that went. That's a big difference between what they're doing now with the Starlink program. That's full blast. They plan, like I said, 24 launches. That's just for Starlink. Now he's got contracts with foreign countries. He's got contracts with NASA to keep sending cargo vehicles up. Eventually a manned mission by maybe 4 months from now. I don't know if he's going to get his 24 launches, but it will be the most launches that SpaceX ever did in 1 year. The most they did so far is 18. And these are very heavy launches for the satellites. Like I said, each one weighs 500 pounds. So you're looking at over 34,000 pounds for each launch. To give you an idea, Hubble Space Telescope, you know, everybody talks about that. It's as big as a school bus, over 40 feet long. And, you know, at one point it's 15 feet in diameter near the top of the aperture. It's 13.